The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Let me start with your name, because what's the story behind the name Pepper? Because I don't know if that's your birth name or not, but either way, it sounds like there's a story behind it.
Yes, there is, and it is my real name. My grandmother's maiden name was Pepper, and she passed away a few years before I was born, so I became quick namesake. And I never actually thought it was an unusual name because I had so many cousins around the area with the last name Pepper. I just thought I was one more Pepper with my own twist on it. And then I realized I got to college, and it was good because everybody knew my name, and it made it feel a little less new and scary. And professionally, I can call clients and if I had called you just now and said just my first name, you'd still be sure you knew who you were talking to.
Exactly. It's nice to have a unique name like that. I'm curious whether you know who Pepper Anderson is in the annals of TV programming.
Yes. And you know what's really funny is, I've been married a long time, and even at that, no one ever mentioned to me once Pepper Anderson until after I got married, changed my name, the whole thing, and then someone said it, and I was like, oh, no, I really had my fingers crossed. And I looked her up, and I thought, that's all right. That's pretty good combination. And then side benefit in the modern age is it makes me a little bit less straightforward to Google, because her fan club comes up before I do.
So Angie Dickinson and Policewoman and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. When your name sounded familiar, it sounded familiar to me because I used to watch the show. I'm old enough to where I would watch the show, and I Googled it, and it's like, sure enough, it was like, oh, my God, there she is, Angie Dickinson.
I love it. She was a great, great lady, and the character, talk about female empowerment, so what's not to love?
Exactly.
So let's talk about where you grew up. Where was that?
I grew up outside Philadelphia in the suburbs on the main line, so near the area where Villanova University is, etc.
And could you describe your childhood in maybe a word or a sentence?
I grew up pretty far outside of the city, so we had a barn and horses, and I was outside most of the day, so I think it gave me a great imagination and sense of adventure, and so in that way, that just sounds simpler, right?
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, though. So your rural Philadelphia, let's say, was it New Jersey, Pennsylvania, or?
No, where I grew up is more toward the direction of Wilmington, so basically like the halfway point between Philly and Wilmington, essentially.
Got it. Okay. So in Delaware?
Yeah.
Okay.
The overall area is referred to as the Main Line because originally the whole sort of set of little towns were built along the train line that people took as they ventured further and further outside of Philly. And the train line was literally called the Main Line.
Got it. So here you are in rural Philadelphia, but you go to Tulane University, become a member of the Green Wave there. Why
yes.
Tulane?
The 17-year-old in me wanted to go to a warmer climate, and I also had done a lot of traveling. I'd spent some time in Spain in high school, so I spoke Spanish, and I love history, so I started thinking about Latin American studies, and Tulane had and has still a very strong program. At the time, I believe they were the number one program for private universities. And the size felt like bigger than my small experience, but not so big that I'd be swallowed up.
So what did you, I think I missed what you studied. You got a bachelor's degree in what line of study? Was it history?
Latin American studies.
Latin American studies, got it, okay.
It lets you take classes within that, like the language and literature piece, obviously, but also a lot of econ and history, and just it gives you room for a lot of breadth, actually.
Well, one thing you and I have in common was we both went to schools looking for warmth. I grew up in upstate New York and went to Arizona State, so I understand the desire to...
Yeah, that'll do it, right?
Much warmer.
I know. It came down to Tulane or this one other school that was, you know, kind of isolated in a small town, like fully snowed in all year. My dad wanted me to go there, and I was like, really, like, just it's not going to happen. I actually wasn't allowed to apply to Tulane, so when I got in early, it was a little bit of a family issue.
Oh, wow.
He didn't want me a plane flight away.
What did you have in mind with Latin American studies? Did you study simply because you had an interest in it, or did you have a career in mind as well?
I didn't have a career in mind necessarily. I felt very interested in an adventure, and I was an international kind of thinker, I think, through the traveling I did and through history, and so something that sort of broadened my horizons was, by definition, intriguing, and I thought, I spoke a second language, and that was an aspect that could be helpful to me. And I thought that I would be able to maybe do good as well.
Tell me about your years in college, just kind of what your lifestyle was like. Were you involved in Greek life? I mean, were you a sorority member? Did you like
the
French? You were. Okay. Which sorority was it?
Yep. Chi Omega.
So do you had a lot of good times in college? And I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but you had parties, right?
You know, New Orleans is a really unique culture, more than I'd even appreciated going in. The food and music scene, and I grew up playing piano, so music was very much a part of my life. And so in some aspects, it was the stereotypical Greek life, but on the other hand, New Orleans, you can see amazing performers live in tiny venues. And I think that's, you know, that was such a different experience from what a lot of my friends had the opportunity to be. Like lots of jazz and just everywhere you went. I just went back from my 25th year reunion, and we did just that. We'd go, you know, with my old friends, we all went and walked around, ate dinner, and just walked around and popped into, you know, tiny joints and listened to great music.
If you were to identify a single characteristic that contributed most to your success, what would you say?
I think two. One is, although they're probably connected, open-mindedness. I think most people's careers aren't linear, and so for me, there are a lot of opportunities that have come up that I would not have chosen or thought that I would be good at. A lot of strategy ideas as a leader I've gotten from other people. And I think it also helps you to hear feedback when you're open. And the second one is diplomacy. I think success, particularly in a leadership context, requires you to both hear others and be heard, and you can't do either if the way you think and communicate feels combative. Those are two very related things, but have sort of different manifestations for me.
Tell us about your experience as an equity trader at Bear Stearns. Was that where your career started? Was that your entry into financial services?
My first job was at Bear, and I wasn't there for very long, and I wasn't licensed in trading. I was the most junior that any person could possibly be, and it was eye-opening because nobody cared what schools I'd gone to, what I had accomplished before. The only thing that mattered was how well I did my job, and I'd never been the least skilled or valuable person in a group before. And I came in knowing basically nothing about markets. I didn't know a single acronym. And it was humbling, but I think it really toughened me up and made me comfortable being uncomfortable, to use a trite phrase.
Why did you get the job?
I got the job because I had the basic qualifications, which was, you know, a college degree, and I think I was probably over eager in terms of my interest in learning, and I was willing to do anything. I didn't have a preset expectation of what I was supposed to be spending my time on or what I required for myself. So I think I was probably very easy to manage and flexible in a business that needed a lot of you know, small tasks done.
So I see you also were a fixed income portfolio manager at Meredith Martin and Kane and Union Bank of Switzerland. Now, was Meredith Martin and Kane the successor job to Bear Stearns?
Yes. I met one of the partners at a wedding, and she and I really connected. And just when I was starting to learn something about equity, she was in fixed income. And I said, you know, I should be very upfront and say I know nothing about fixed income. And she said, "That's okay. You seem smart and eager." And looking back, I know I was in over my head initially, but MMK was a very small company, and many of us were quite young. I think only the partners were over 30 or 35. And I think that created an atmosphere where we all perceived opportunity if we put the effort in, and those who had more experience happened to be good mentors. And we were purchased by UBS, and I evolved from being a jack of all trades in a small firm to a more structured role. And to me, that was a pretty serious 180, and one that I feel lucky I had in terms of a pivot, because so much of one's early career experiences are about finding out what you're great at and the environment that sets you up for success. And I felt a very tangible difference in my energy when I wasn't able to go outside of my job description, outside my role.
Now, you ended up leaving that position at UBS and joining Chilton Trust in July 2019, is that correct?
Nope. There's a whole 22-year piece in the middle.
Oh, tell me about it.
Yeah, I wondered why you didn't ask about that. I was like, that's a long chunk. That's really the meat and the potatoes of it. So I met a young portfolio manager at MMK, and when that firm was bought by UBS, she left and went to JP Morgan, and she was my first real mentor. And so I went to JP Morgan to follow her because I felt like there were clearly things you could learn from a larger organization, and yet I did want to be more entrepreneurial and more flexible. And so I stayed in fixed income, but I went to join her, and we were the sort of client portfolio management team in fixed income. And over time, as that business grew, and as if you think about all of the things over the couple of decades there that changed in the overall environment and changed for JP Morgan, so I joined Morgan Guaranty Trust Company, which I think had about 15,000 people. And by the end, I left JP Morgan Chase, 250,000 people, in a very different role than I'd ever started in. So, like, those were the most meaningful stepping stones in my life professionally.
So 22 years there, you saw a lot of changes there. I'm curious whether you ever had any direct exposure to Jamie Dimon.
Yes. And he's a great example to me of how important it is to think about your own personal brand and your energy, because the amazing thing about him is that it trickles all the way through the company. And very few people have the ability to have that kind of outsized personal impact on others, but I found it very motivating.
organization.
You know, people always talk about, like, as a leader, like, you should cast a wide shadow, and it's something you have to work at. And you have to be consistent, and you also, I think, have to be authentic. Like, who you are in big forums needs to be the same as who you are one-on-one in its own version. And I think that's what he has done so well. And so that's a, it was a great sort of learning experience for me.
Were you still doing the fixed income portfolio management by time you departed J.P. Morgan?
No, I switched like maybe halfway in, about 10 years or so. It was right actually in the sort of early days of the financial crisis. I give J.P. Morgan a lot of credit for supporting my growth. I went to my manager at the time, who was another great mentor of mine, and I told him that I felt like I was getting a little stale and I needed to get uncomfortable again, and I wanted to be a little bit over my skis. And I don't think he'd seen a lot of people kind of put themselves out of a good job before, so he laughed a little bit. But there was so much going on. We had just gone through the Chase merger a little while before, and there was a lot of integration to be done. So there were whole departments that I think needed to get figured out. And so I had a series of really different and interesting leadership roles on the investment side. And then ultimately that segued to being the manager of advisor groups, which are at J.P. Morgan in the private bank, structured, generally speaking, around geographies. And so that's how, you know, I had a couple of different roles there, how by the end I was managing the Greenwich, Connecticut office, which covers Connecticut and Westchester. So I used to be very specific in one type of investment, then I got general on investments, and then I got really broad on clients and all the platform, but really specific on geography. So it's all different versions.
So then I suspect a headhunter called you and said, hey, we'd like to talk to you about a position at Chilton Trust. Is that the way it happened?
Yes. And it was a headhunter who had been calling on me for several years, and I just... Yeah, this one, she said, I know you always say no, but this one you're going to want to think about, and you will want to have this meeting. I said, oh, okay. So I did, and it clicked pretty immediately for me.
Well, what was the difference? Why did she say this one you should listen to? Was it that they offered you the CEO position previously? It was not the CEO position?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't even that. I think it was just, you know, J.P. Morgan, to me, is best in class in its category. And so for me to have moved to another large firm didn't seem compelling. To go to a smaller firm, one that was at the perfect intersection of having been around long enough to be credible and have a great platform, but young enough that the firm's 10 years old, young enough to have a really interesting opportunity ahead was really exciting. And when you are with first-class people doing it, that was great. And I also really connected with the ethos of the firm. Every single decision is made with clients' best interests first. It's the director from the top, from Richard Chilton. It's the reason why he founded the firm. And I also perceived a benefit as a result of being a private company and being able to think strategically and long-term. So our goal is to be a multi-generational advisor for the families we work with. And I like, as a leader, being grounded in that, then backing into the priorities for our company near our term, and that's just not something that any public company is in a position to do. So it was more about personal, just reflecting on where I was in my own career at that point and
what was going to be exciting for the next chapter. I feel like I'm old enough to have credibility, but young enough to have a really important and exciting next chapter.
I see. So the headhunter that was calling you, she was offering you positions at other organizations. It was not that she came to you about Chilton Trust several times, but by the time she came to you about Chilton
Trust. She would just call me periodically, like, you know, once in a while when other leadership opportunities came up. And I, you know, I think I must have shared with her over time kind of what it would have to be. And I'm, you know, if what you have is good already, and, you know, the adage, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I didn't feel like I needed to change. And so for me to do something different, it had to be something that represented a real pivot and a new challenge and a different way of applying my experiences. And this very clearly was that.
Well, and on top of that, chief executive. So you come to Chilton Trust. You have not been there that long. It's July 2019that you take the position. So what were you asked to do with the organization? Because you said the ethos is a very good one there, and it comports with how you feel about the way business should be conducted. Did they ask you to bring some of the best practices and principles of J.P. Morgan Chase into the organization? What basically was kind of your portfolio, but what was Mr. Chilton asking you to do for the organization?
Not specifically J.P. Morgan practices, because they're specific to the stage that J.P. Morgan's at. But I think there was a nice balance between the fact, and he had told me this during the interview process, nothing's broken. There's nothing to fix. And I thought, you know, I'm like, how can that be? And the reality is, it's not, that was true. And the opportunity really is to think about growth in the by just telling our story to more people, thinking strategically about how to expand within our current footprint as well as new geographies. Think about our platform, if there are things that we should be challenging ourselves on in terms of new services or continuing to evolve what we do for our clients. And that balance, I think one of the reasons why we all connected was because I, as a leader, am not, you know, a broken china type. I like to really learn and observe and make lots of small turns to the dial. And with an organization that's already doing well and just is trying to think longer term about growth and challenge itself, that I think that style was a good match.
So let's talk about your own financial situation as far as whether you're a spender or a saver. Some people love to spend money. Some people have kind of a, you know, never know what's going to happen in the future, better save it. What would you count yourself as, a spender or a saver?
Both. I'm just very specific about what I spend money on. I spend on travel, food, education, philanthropy, and in lots of other areas, I'm either a bargain hunter or I abstain completely. I don't buy fancy coffee out. I make it at home every morning. So I don't like food going bad in the refrigerator. So I value experiences and I hate waste.
What about travel? Do you have a favorite continent or country?
I like things that are kind of off the grid. One of the best trips we took recently was last spring to Patagonia.
Oh.
And it's an incredibly humbling place to be because it's so big and clean. You are reminded where you fit in the universe in a way. And we are our family. We are outdoorsy. So I love seeing all different places in the world. And then we also spend time every summer in Maine, and that's the place where I've been every summer of my entire life. And it gives you a physical response when you associate such peace and like serenity in a location. So I love that my husband and my kids feel the same thing there. So I'm essentially a clean air, take it outdoors vacationer.
If I was to look at your portfolio, if I was to be so bold as to look at your portfolio, would I decide that you're risk averse or risk tolerant?
Risk tolerant. And I've taught myself to be risk tolerant because I know that my investment horizon is long, and I've seen too many times, and I've done myself, where investors succumb to fear when markets decline. And I've been through those cycles. I've made the behavioral finance mistakes, and that helps me to heed my own advice in planning. So I am almost fully in equity as a result.
Interesting. So what is your favorite asset or asset class?
Probably not very creative, but U.S. equity, I like the return profile, and I like the fact that I can, I feel like I can understand the macro dynamics, and there's great transparency in the market.
If you were to drill down a little, if I was to drill down a little bit, is there a particular sector that you, or two, that you're especially high on right now?
No, I and perhaps this is something that's really been brought out by Chilton, but I'm a bottoms up person, and I think great companies with long term growth can exist everywhere and in all sectors and all market capitalizations. And if I have a long term time horizon, I'm an absolute return investor also, so I am not anchored overly to benchmarks. Of course, I'd like to beat them, but I'm not using that as my starting point.
You know, I wanted to ask you what your favorite place is to do business outside the office. You may have answered that because you talk about working at home on Sunday afternoons.
I really like seeing clients in their own homes or their offices because it gives me a really good sense of who they are. And I think can often make them feel most comfortable, and that's where wealth management is a bit different from other areas of the financial world, is it's not just about markets. It's about addressing very sensitive and personal family issues, so being comfortable is important.
There are a lot of CEOs who just say, well, I don't see clients anymore. I've got a team to do that.
I don't know how you actually would manage a business to the best of your ability if you aren't experiencing it yourself. So, you know, I need to hear directly from clients. And by the way, I think anyone who's successful in this business views that as the fun part. So part of that is selfish. I really enjoy it. I like problem solving. I like the relationships with people. And I think sometimes I get different feedback because of my role than another person on the team might get. And it's really important. You know, if I go back to the goal I have and the reason why I'm here, you know, I need to know what clients think and what they want from us. If I'm thinking about what's the next step for the company, it doesn't matter what I think. It matters what they think and what they would find helpful.
So ultimately, you're in charge of hiring. And I'm curious, what kind of people do you try to draw to Chilton Trust? Who do you want to surround yourself with? And maybe even bring this down to a level of when they walk in to do for an interview, whether it's with you or one of your team members there, what are you looking for in terms of the way they dress, the way they speak, the things they emphasize? Can you shed a little bit of light on that?
Yes. I say the way they speak. I am a total grammar nerd. Maybe this is my upbringing, but I don't think it's too hard to be well spoken, but it's a worthwhile priority. In terms of the kind of people, to say I only like, quote, good people sounds a bit trite, but I really like people who are authentic. And within that, I like variety. Professionally, people whose roles and backgrounds are different from mine tend to ask questions I may not have thought of or forced me to explain my ideas in more detail, which helps me find the holes. So I like to build teams with that kind of complementary perspective. And in terms of the actual interview processes, I don't like being sold. I want to know, honestly, what people are great at and what their process is so I can understand how replicable it is and how well it fits with us. I also want to know what they view as their development opportunities and if it's something I have the ability to help them with and therefore give them a greater chance of growing within their role and having a long-term future with us.
So I know that authenticity is something that you know it when you see it, but can you define
yeah.
it? I mean, what makes a person authentic? And can you give a statement as to what authenticity really is as far as a description?
It is hard to describe, you're right. It's sort of, you do know it when you see it. I think sometimes people feel a need to be overly formal, and it's clear when someone is relaxed enough to show you who they are, but still professional. I've interviewed and managed so many people over time that, I don't like trick questions in interviews or, hardball. What I really want to get at is who they truly are, and so I'd rather make people comfortable and give them the ability to open up to me rather than try to break them down and see how many hard questions they can answer.
So are you an introvert or an extrovert?
All of my friends would tell you that I'm an extrovert, but in reality, I think I'm a bit of both because I have trained myself over time to be more of an extrovert than I am by nature. So, for example, I have always found it awkward to walk up to a group of people I don't know and join in the conversation. But that's a very practical and necessary skill in my business, so I've pushed past my discomfort, and the practice makes everything easier, so I think I've trained myself to be an extrovert.
Who's your mentor, and what did he or she teach you?
I had three mentors who I think really shaped me, and they're very different from each other. But what they had in common was they each gave me very direct feedback, sometimes brutally direct, and put me in roles that I would not have envisioned for myself. And I think now, as I reflect on them, I'm probably a patchwork quilt of attributes I learned from each of them. So the first one, she gave me confidence because she would put me over my skis. The first new business presentation I ever did, she basically walked out of the room as we were walking in. She basically put me in charge, and knowing that I was prepared, and I won, and I did a great job on it. But she basically ripped the Band-Aid right off. And second one taught me to be a good leader. This is the guy who asked me to manage the equity team. He taught me how to give good feedback, how to take it, how to make hard decisions. He was my manager through the financial crisis, and there were some really painful decisions that had to be made, and he helped me understand that that's part of leadership also. And so he gave me a lot of strength and to be a good leader. And then the third helped me to be open-minded. We argued about a lot of strategic plans and the vision and how to get there. And but ultimately, we were also really good friends. And so we had a very open and healthy dialogue about it. And I realized that, you know, I was sometimes coming in already having decided what the answer was before I got enough information. And so you put all those together, and I feel really lucky. And each of them actually was a helpful counsel to me when I was making this decision to come to Chilton.
So describe your leadership style.
Transparent and inclusive. Hopefully a good balance between patience and courage. I think businesses get the best results from people when everyone knows what the goals are and why, so they can get on board and ask the questions they need in order to do so. And embracing change and evolution is important, but I like to watch and learn before laying out goals to be sure I understand how to calibrate them.
Where is the future growth of your organization going to come from? I'm especially interested also, Pepper, in this whole intergenerational or next generation, where the parents are handing over their fortunes, which we're seeing in a big way with baby boomers. And a lot of organizations are worried about being able to hang on to those customers, to the next generation, because just a lot of young people have different ideas about where they want to, who they want to work with and whatnot, and not necessarily their parents' advisor. So where's the growth going to come from, and what about that next generation being able to retain them and their assets, it and its assets?
Yeah. I think for us in particular, growth has been organic, and it will remain that way to a certain extent. I am doing some hiring, and our clients introduce us to people, and that's the intimacy aspect that I really like about this business. But we would very selectively consider acquisitions. The challenge with acquisitions is finding the fit on paper, but then also the fit of culture. And we are very proud of our culture internally, and it's sacrosanct, so I can't necessarily depend on it as a growth tool. So I think we're very open-minded to how we get there. And in terms of the next gen, I think that the industry, generally speaking, makes a lot of mistakes in relationship management, and it has manifested in advisors connecting with only one spouse, and you see the same ramifications there. So I think a lot of these lessons have been learned, and they're in the process of evolving. I'm not sure that the next generation, by definition, is like technology and self-serving, self-service obsessed. I think you have to understand each individual person and what they're looking to achieve. I think sometimes change, it just happens for change's sake, so you can spark a new relationship. I don't think anybody wants to come into a position of leadership in their family and be interacted with as if they're a child. You know, it's up to us to understand families well in advance of that transfer of leadership.
So talk about the investment approach at Chilton Trust. So if you're bringing a client on board, or you're discussing a would-be client, let's say, you know, what does Chilton Trust have to offer me? What's the answer to that? What's the approach? What do you have to offer, and what's the investment approach?
This firm, and this is probably one of the most important reasons that I was attracted to Chilton Trust, is because it closely mirrors a lot of how I think personally. So the firm was founded on the premise of customization, and really starting with clients' objectives and not necessarily looking to subscribe them to model portfolios. So we are long-term, absolute return-oriented, rather than strictly adherent to models. That said, we do the analysis on the company side when we're investing, and the same approach for our third-party managers. And we like to be very transparent with our clients, let them see different scenarios, let them really understand every component of their portfolio, both in terms of risk and return profile as well as cost. And then what's interesting is that's the investment piece of it, but what a lot of people value is all of the service that goes around it, which is in the traditional sense of just white glove service every day, but it's also family office type services. And this is where maybe each generation will be different, where one person wants to spend the time to understand their bills and run their own spreadsheets to keep an eye on their assets. Another person taking that responsibility on might want to have it outsourced. And so the flexibility to mold ourselves around clients.
So are you and your team active or passive investors? I suspect it's a combination.
Active.
You are active. Okay. So your average portfolio would have what percent? I know this is a difficult question because all clients are different, but if you were to peanut butter it, your average portfolio, how much, what percentage of it would be illiquid?
That also depends. A lot of our clients have significant allocations to illiquid assets already on their balance sheets. So, you know, for example, real estate, you talk about Charlotte and the development there. A lot of our clients are focused on, you know, investing there. And so our portfolios are 100% liquid. You know, clients who themselves are in the private equity industry, they may not allow us to, or it might not be appropriate for us to have additional illiquidity. Someone who is, you know, living off of the portfolio and not otherwise constrained, you know, might generally see, you know, 10% broad brush. I don't necessarily think that this is the optimal environment to be increasing illiquidity. So right now, what we've been focused on is more like niche strategies where we think that there are unique opportunities rather than building big allocations in private equity or hedge funds right now. So those opportunities you will participate in smaller bite sizes and more opportunistically.
So what are some of the niche strategies you would be, you're high on right now?
We've focused, well, there's a couple we're reviewing right now that not sure where we're going to go with, but the most recent things we've done have been in real estate.
And is it direct investing or is it through...
Through managers generally.
Yeah, okay. So if you could characterize your client base, well, how would you just summarize the overall makeup or profile of your client base?
I think our clients, like most firms, are pretty broad in profile. What they generally have in common is a level of complexity that has led them to choose us to deliver transparency and portfolios customized around their other interests. I was actually surprised for a small firm when I came here. I thought that there would be a more consistent profile, but I think, you know, it's such a personal business. I think a lot of our clients have had experiences with larger firms, and they value, they can appreciate the benefits of having a large platform and what they like from us, either as an addition or an alternative to those experiences, is the intimacy. So that's not necessarily reflective of any point in life or profession.
Are you guys looking to add any offices? I notice right now you've got, what, five offices, it looks like, all of them on the East Coast. I don't know if you're looking to expand out west or Midwest, or but are you expecting that offices will be added in the near term?
I don't anticipate focusing on the West anytime soon, because we have so much opportunity still closer to home. But we would consider adding offices near or within our current footprint. So probably more likely to be in the Southeast.
When you have a new client come in, they're coming in from a different organization, they've been working with different advisors. What is the, is there a common issue that you see when they come in the door? Let me give you an example. What I've heard in the past is a lot of times they're over-diversified, that they people think diversification means throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall, but in reality, you can't even figure out what's working and what isn't, because there's just too much going on in the portfolio. Do you? And I don't know if that's the case with what you're seeing, or are there some other issues that you need to address immediately, oftentimes with new clients?
I think that's a huge issue, and again, this may be a slightly cynical way to say it, but I think as there has been so much decompression, I think that all advisors are working harder and harder to identify ways to add value. And then when you think about how complicated markets have become over the last couple of decades, it's not surprising that diversification itself would potentially become exaggerated. So I think that's definitely something that we hear a lot about and see in portfolios. It's one of the reasons why we focus on transparency, because I also think sometimes clients aren't completely sure what they're paying. So it's performance, it's cost, and so I see that a lot. And the desire for just higher touch, more personalization. I think it's the other side of the coin from the technology and all the advantages of it, is most people don't want technology to be a substitute for trust and intimacy. They want it to amplify their relationship.